You don't have to be involved in socialist politics for very long to come across a series of arguments that seem to refute some of our basic claims, usually put forward by right-wing forces. One of the most potent and pervasive is the idea that the Australian working class is relatively conservative, is complacent, is bought off, and is integrated into capitalism. That the prospects of material comfort, the prospects of material advancement, possibly the buying up a small store, becoming a self-employed contractor, maybe employing one or two staff, are a route for upward mobility of the Australian working class, and therefore break up any potential cohering of a working class consciousness, working class organisation in Australia. And that the politics of the Australian Labor Party, which of course revolutionary is castigated as being conservative, opportunist, are nothing but the reflection of the conservative and generally complacent politics of Australian working class. Therefore, ergo, this argument goes, revolutionaries are dreamers. You know, there are no more chance of being a revolution in Australia than there could be one on the moon. Now, this argument that the Australian working class is complacent and bought off and integrated within the system is not restricted just to the right wing. In fact, there have been a series of left-wing writers who've also made similar arguments. I'm going to deal first of all with those. Then I'm going to deal with a couple of other arguments we also hear. One to do with the romanticised, if you like, the argument goes to the extent that the mainstream Australian workers are bought off by capitalism, so revolutionary prospects have to reside in the marginals, the outcasts, the unemployed, the casually employed worker, the itinerant. And a final argument, if you like, is different again, but also, in fact, what all these arguments have in common is they deny the activity, the presence, the consciousness of a united working class. The final argument is that the working class is nothing other than the democratic vanguard of the Australian people united in struggle against a thin layer of parasitical foreigners, monopolists, banks, squatters, and so forth. So, that's what it talks about. I've had a number of people come up to me and say, what's this talk about? Well, that's what it's about. So if you're interested in that, stick around. Okay, so taking up this first argument, does the Australian working class exist? Well, in some ways, I guess most socialists here would have some conception about the size of the working class, its organisation, trade unions, and so forth. But this argument does not necessarily focus just on the present day. It goes back to the period when the Australian working class was becoming, we would argue, a cohesive force in its own right, both a class in itself, as Marx put it, and also a class for itself. That argument is disputed by a famous Marxist labour historian by the name of Humphrey McQueen. Humphrey McQueen wrote a very influential book about 35 years ago called The New Britannia, in which he argued that a series of conditions that prevailed in colonial Australia in the late 19th century meant that the Australian working class was a weakling force. He argued that the conditions in the colonies, in particular the wealth that existed due to the seizure of the land, the small size of the workshops, which meant that there were close and familial relationships between workers and bosses, in other words, owners, the fact that in the rural industries, wages were relatively high due to labour shortages, abundant land and imported capital, the fact that many workers like shearers and miners crossed over between being proletarian and being small business owners, that is self-employed in their own right, all these things meant that the Australian working class had no resemblance to the working class you would see in Berlin, St. Petersburg, London or Manchester. That is, the working class was relatively dispersed. It had strong potential of upward mobility. It was relatively prosperous. It had close relations with its employers. And this meant, in fact, that the working class was not able to put its stamp on Australian society. In fact, the working class was sidelined, in fact, by the petty bourgeoisie. That a sizable working class did not emerge in Australia, but in fact, in its place, arose a rural and urban petty bourgeoisie instead of a proletariat. And that the ideology of this petty bourgeoisie, its individualism, its liberalism, in preference to the collectivism and socialism of the working class, is what determined the politics of the Australian Labor Party. So you can see here, despite the very different kind of motivation on the part of Humphrey and McQueen, who after all identify with the left, the argument comes down to the same, ultimately, as the right-wing argument, which is the prospects of mobility, relative wealth of the Australian working class meant that it couldn't really be called a working class in a meaningful sense. It was neither a class in itself, nor was it a class for itself. That was one argument I want to deal with. I'll come up with the counter-arguments in a moment. A similar argument made on the left has its origins in the arguments of Lenin. Interestingly, one of the areas of Lenin's politics, in fact, that Socialist Alternative disagrees with. Lenin argued, in his attempt to find out why it was that the Labour parties of Europe threw themselves behind their rulers in support of the First World War, Lenin tried to trace that conservative political stance to the mass, not the mass base, well, he contradicted himself. He traced it to the so-called labour aristocracy. He said, and his arguments changed over time, and it's difficult to pinpoint actually who he meant, either the entire working class, which is rather how Engels described the British working class, wrongly, in the 1870s, or for Lenin, a minority within the working class, had been bought off by imperialism. That the imperialist plunder of the colonies had allowed some crumbs to fall off the imperialist table, which was seized by the working class, which enabled it to enjoy a high living standard, and thereby to mitigate any radical, class-conscious, militant sentiment amongst the European working class, particularly the British, the German working classes. Now, of course, Lenin didn't have a lot to say about Australia. This argument has, however, been taken up by another left-wing current in Australia, known as the Democratic Socialist Party. The Democratic Socialist Party, otherwise known as the Socialist Alliance, argue that there is an inherent tendency within Australian working class towards conservatism, which is based upon Lenin's argument of the labour aristocracy transposed down under. The DSP argues that the Australian working class is irretrievably divided between the skilled trades and the unskilled, and that the politics of skilled trades forms a basis of the opportunist, bureaucratic, set-up politics of Australian Labor Party. He argues that the complacent, bought-off, well-paid skilled trades actually inform the politics of the Labor Party with its desire to suck up the capital. So Peter Boyle, one of the DSP's leading writers, argues that the working class is highly stratified and becoming more and more so. And he writes in 2002, mark you, the growing privilege of the securely employed. So, you know, bad luck people like me, university academics, whose jobs in fact are getting cut out from underneath our feet. But I'll come to that in a moment. So one argument is the argument between the skilled trades and the unskilled. The other argument, in fact, is the entire Australian working class has been bought off by the crumbs of, maybe not imperialism, the crumbs of, you like, the British Empire more generally, and by the plunder of the land from the Aboriginal people. And that, therefore, the Australian working class has no material interest in smashing imperialism, fighting for national liberation of oppressed and colonial peoples. Because, the argument goes, the Australian working class has been bought off by imperialism and by the seizure of the land from the Aborigines. And so, the DSP argues, the generally sluggish and moderate politics of the Australian working class have their origins in the imperialist nature of Australian settlement. And this again has contemporary relevance for today. Peter Boyle argues that race, under the war on terror, racism and xenophobia is being revived. And a material basis for this is not what you might think it is, you know, the US war drive, a desire to control the Middle East, but, quote, the relative privilege of workers in the imperialist countries. So, the reformist politics of the ALP, the DSP argues, the politics of opportunism, simply reflects the interests of a layer, or indeed, the entire Australian working class. So, dealing first up with this argument, I'm going to focus mostly here on some of the situation of the Australian working class as it was between about the 1870s and the 1920s, because this is where this argument really has its origins. First up, the argument that the Australian working class is complacent, integrated, bought off, whatever, actually completely is overridden, is disputed by the facts of Australian working class at the end of the 19th century. It's true, wages were higher in Australia than they were in the UK. Nonetheless, these higher wages did not translate equally to all workers. And obviously, the wealth went overwhelmingly to the squatters, the industrialists, the bankers, and so forth. If you were to walk around the working class areas of Sydney, you'd be immediately struck by the shanty housing, the regular epidemics of diseases, the bouts of unemployment, and then if you were to observe the conditions of the battles between the workers and employers, you'd see the low wages, the predominance of casual work, and the ruthless employers. Most unskilled workers showed no signs of having been bought off by empire. They had no social security to fall back on, and the lot generally was, well, as a British politician put it, nasty, brutish, and short in most cases. They slaved in poor conditions, as shearers, as railway workers. And far from there being, you know, a land of milk and honey for the working class, the only wealth census ever undertaken in 1915 found that the top 5% of the population held 2/3 of the entire nation's wealth. And the vast majority of workers own little more than their clothes and their furniture. So Australia clearly had a working class. The task ahead of it was to organise. The argument that labour aristocracy theory makes is the crumbs of the imperialist table fall into the laps of the working class. This would have been news to any union militant in the late 19th century, indeed throughout the 20th century. The history of the workers' movement in Australia is not one where workers sat back and just counted the cash as it landed on the table. It's a struggle between bosses and workers for the formation, the smashing, the reformation, the smashing once again, and the reformation of a trade union movement. In the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, you see desperate struggles to build trade unions and to win basic rights like the 40-hour week annual leave. And whether these workers were school teachers, whether they were skilled trades, whether they were wharfies, they all had to fight for their rights. And to believe, as the DSP puts it, that the Australian working class today, or even a section of it, is bribed by imperialism and is given the profits of imperialism and can afford to sit back and relax, clearly did not go to any of the work choices demonstrations. The argument about the labour aristocracy, the idea that skilled workers in particular formed a layer that was bought off and the unskilled workers were the ones that wanted to fight, and the idea that the Labour Party simply represented the interests of the conservative, quote, skill trades, actually is based upon a false transposition of the British experience in the latter part of the 19th century. In the British experience, it was true that from about the 1850s onwards, after the smashing of Chartism, there grew up a layer of conservative craft unions. Highly sectional, highly bureaucratised, these are the bowler hat, gentleman gym trade unions, the ones who had exclusive skilled trades, and they were damned if they're going to let the Irish, the women, the Catholics take a job in their factory in a skilled position. Along in 1889 came the gas workers' strike, the waterside workers' strike, the activity of the radical labour movement organisers, people like Tom Mann, Eleanor Marx, and a range of other influential figures. So-called new unionism movement, based upon the unskilled workers. The argument about Australian unions is, if you like, a lazy transposition that same process occurred in Australia. In fact, the evolution of the Australian labour movement was rather different. Because, in fact, there were unskilled and semi-skilled unions reaching back, in fact, to the 1860s and 1870s. the New South Wales coal miners formed a union as far back as 1860. The Victorian gold miners followed in 1872. The seamen formed the union in 1876, and the wharfies over the course of 1882 to 1885. So unskilled workers got a good run-up to forming unions, in fact, going back to the 1860s and 1870s, alongside the urban crafts, the metal trades, the building trades, and the printers. So these unskilled unions were not the kind of all-in general unionism that we saw with British unions in the 1890s. In fact, it was neither the case that the unskilled unions in Australia were militant, all-in class fighters spurning arbitration, and the craft unions were this timid, meek, cap in hand, king and empire. That was not at all a completely false characterisation of the Australian union movement. Plenty of unskilled unions were, in fact, relatively passive. In fact, their unskilled status meant at times their fear of taking strike action. Many of them spent most of their money on benefit funds for funerals, accidents, and so on. They levied quite high membership fees, which kept out many unskilled workers. The best example of an unskilled union, which was an example of conservatism, moderation, was, of course, Australian Workers' Union. Australian Workers' Union was notorious, an unskilled workers' union, notorious for its conservatism from quite early on. By 1900, the Australian Workers' Union had replaced direct election of officials by their appointment by small state and national conferences dominated by full-timers. So it's not the case that we saw these unskilled unions driving forward, smashing the bosses. What about the craft unions? Well, in fact, the craft unions, many of them leveraged their strategic strength in strikes. Now, generally speaking, they preferred the threat of the strike. They're in relatively short supply, so they could negotiate with the boss with the threat of the strike in the back pocket. But when the chips were down, they did strike. And they were also not conservative and complacent, bought off. Increasingly, the skilled trades from the 1880s onwards, they may have been in a relatively privileged position in the 1850s and 1860s, but by the 1880s and 1890s were under threat from de-skilling, from mechanisation. The social fluidity of colonial Australia in the 1850s was beginning to evaporate, and people began to find themselves more and more locked into particular social stations. The prospects of elevation and promotion by owning your own business and employing one or two people, those opportunities began to dry up. So in contrast to the argument that's put to describe the British working class of a clear differentiation, in fact, the Australian working class became a class in itself and to some extent a class for itself relatively early on. Raymond Markey argues, who's written a very good treatment of the formation of the New South Wales Labour Party. Organised labour at the end of the 1880s, began to represent a class rather than a craft elite, both quantitatively in its size, but also in terms of its outlook and policy. And we only have to bring the story forward to the 20th century to understand this idea of a stark contrast between a conservative, craft-skilled section of the Australian working class and an explosive, unskilled section does not, in fact, bear up to reality. We see a whole series of craft unions with a strong tradition of striking and political radicalism. Because after all, the skilled trades in the railway workshops in the 1917 general strike which sparked off that explosion. You only have to read Tom Sheridan's book on the Amalgamated Engineering Union to understand the proud history of that union in solidarity, in international struggle, in striking and rolling the bosses back. It was the skilled printing workers who in 1945 won the 40-hour week. I think it was in New South Wales. It was the building trades, mark you, not the building of labourers, the BWIU and its various component parts, the Carpenters Union, and the skilled building trades who actually were deregistered repeatedly in the 1940s and 1950s, such as their industrial militancy. And likewise, when you look at the unskilled workers, some, of course, do have a high strike rate. You know, when you look at things like the meat workers, a proud tradition of struggle. On the other hand, you look at some of the core unskilled workers' unions, like the Australian Workers' Union, like the Miscellaneous Workers' Union, have a reputation of barely striking, very conservative industrially. In other words, we can do away with this idea that you have a militant, explosive, unskilled worker and a bought-off, complacent craft worker. Crucially, when we look at the history of the AU, the Engineers Union, or contrary, look at the history of the AW, the Workers Union, it's questions of leadership, it's questions of organisation, it's questions of politics that come to the forefront in determining their industrial stance. Another problem with his arguments about the labour aristocracy forming the basis of the Australian Labour Party is that it misunderstands the nature of the ALP. The ALP, the conservatism of the ALP, is not the result of the politics of particular layers within the working class, but is in fact the result of, if you like, the seizure of the ALP by the union bureaucracy and by the parliamentary leaders and politicians, which is achieved by the late 1890s. Very quickly, within 10 years of its formation, the essential politics of the Australian Labour Party had been forged. And those politics were determined, as I say, not by a layer within the working class, but by layers within the labour movement bureaucracy, that is, the union leaders and the politicians, that had a stake in the system. It was them, not the craft workers, not the unskilled workers, who were able to determine the politics of the ALP. Far from the skilled workers pushing the ALP into conservative politics, in fact, it was the leadership of the AWU that did the most damage in terms of sucking any early radicalism out of the ALP. And it was the Engineers Union who, far from, you know, being a craft-skilled union, far from fetishising the state, wanting to find our own place within it, precisely because the Engineers Union had the craft strength to hit the boss where it counted, they were very sceptical towards arbitration. Arbitration tended to be looked to by the weak unions, not by the strong. Taking it forward to today, the idea, as the DSP put it, that the opportunist politics of the ALP rest on the skilled sections of the working class is a complete nonsense. In fact, the core voting base of the ALP today and the core membership of Labour Party affiliated unions is in fact the blue-collar, migrant, non-Anglophone workforce in the outer suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne. In other words, the most oppressed sections of the working class are the most likely, in fact, to vote Labour. Oppression in terms of unemployment, income, low education, and so forth. The other base of the Australian Labour Party is white-collar public sector workers, clerical, teachers, health. In most cases, they have become ALP supporters not to foist a right-wing agenda on the ALP as professionals, but in fact by virtue of their proletarianisation, by virtue of the degrading of their working conditions down to the conditions of the blue-collar working class in terms of their insecurity. Talk to any teacher in Victoria or New South Wales about the prospects of them finding permanent work within 5 or 10 years after them graduating from university, and you'll know what I mean. And the idea that reformist parties can only find a base amongst well-paid, you know, workers, skilled workers in imperialist countries, benefiting from the crumbs from imperialism, is disproved by the existence of reformist parties in India, but also more recently, South Africa and Brazil. Finally, the argument about the labour aristocracy and the crumbs of imperialism and so forth can be disputed by the evidence of the Australian working class fighting against imperialism, fighting against racism. Peter Boyle and the DSP argue that the material basis of racism in the Australian working class is the privileges the Australian workers get from imperialism. Now, the record of Australian workers is quite different. and often the record led by skilled workers, such as the engineers, but not just them, the Wharfies as well. The record of supporting independence and national struggles, Indonesia, Vietnam, South Africa, China, and a whole range of other countries. Now, if you were to take the labour aristocracy theory seriously, you'd have to say, this is impossible, or it's counterintuitive. Why would a working class that benefits from the exploitation of the colonies, from the perpetuation of imperialism by its masters, the Australian ruling class, why would they go out and strike in support of a struggle against imperialism? You know, well, it can only be rather befuddled and whatever. They don't understand their class situation. Or because they're just charitable. They're well-meaning. They like to, you know, help out those in need, you know, despite their own material interests, which suggests they do the opposite. But in fact, once you start arguing that, you've got no class basis for arguing for Australian workers to take a stand in support of those crushed by imperialism. It can only be an act of charity, quite contrary to the real material interests of the Australian working class, which means it becomes very difficult, in fact, to argue for Australian workers to solidarise with the struggles of the oppressed overseas. In other words, once you start even a superficial analysis of the argument about the labour aristocracy, the whole concept and construct begins to fall apart. I want to deal briefly with two other arguments. They're based on the argument that, look around you, all you see is so-called conservative, complacent workers. But the resolution, that argument that people like Verity Bergman has made in her struggle about the industrial workers of the world, is to say, at some level, yeah, sure, a whole section of Australian working class is bought off by high wages, the prospect of owning a home, maybe even the prospect of starting your own business. But there's the rootless rebels. There's the radicals. There's the itinerants. They're the people that are kind of the ne'er-do-wells, the casually employed, the worker that goes from job to job, stirring up trouble, lighting the fire, shoving it up the boss, booing the monarchy, you know, refusing to stand up for the national anthem, you know, the kind of the Irish Catholic, Mick? Larrikin spirit of the single man moving from job to, overwhelmingly single men, moving from job to job, no stake in the system, forming the basis of the industrial workers of the world. So goes the argument. These people don't have a stake in the system, they own nothing and they're proud of it. Now, that's one example of that, the IWW, about 1915 or so. Other examples have been used. Pat Mackey, anyone who knows about a big strike, a lockout in 1964 in Mount Isa, well, may have heard of a figure called Pat Mackey. Pat Mackey was the exact exemplar of this type of figure. In fact, he said he belonged to Wobblies. 1964, kind of 50 years after the heyday. He's still identified with a Wobbly spirit. You know, shoved up the bureaucracy, don't trust arbitration, you know, the company of scumbags, don't trust the Labour Party. He seemed to exemplify that kind of larrikin outsider. And more recent studies of the builders' labourers invoked this same kind of idea, the 1970s. The people, you know, they had nothing but their shirts on their backs, but they prepared to take the fight to the system. A similar argument has been put in terms of the migrant working class. Former socialist Constance Lever wrote influential works in the 1970s and 1980s based upon her experience of studying Four Broadmeadows, which had a series of explosive strikes in 1973 and 1981, formed strong shop committees and basically burned the bum off the federal leadership of the Vehicle Builders Union. Constance Lever's argument was the new vanguard of the Australian working class is the migrant workers, dead-end production line jobs, no prospects of mobility, blue-collar, socialist traditions in Italy and Greece and so forth, and hostile to bureaucratic unionism of unions where they tend to be found, the Vehicle Builders Union, the Iron Workers Association. Now, as opposed to labour aristocracy theory, there is actually a germ of truth in some of these arguments, but a one-sided argument. The migrant working class was very exploited in the post-war decades. They did have poor conditions, inhumane work, machine pacing, bullying foremen, racism on the job. Some of the unions basically did ignore them. The Vehicle Builders Union basically took their dues and then shat on them. The result was their outsider status meant they were passive a lot of the time, but when they fought, they had much less of the veneration for the established ways of doing things than did maybe some of the trades in the car factories, like who belonged to the AAU. They had less of a stake in the established system of negotiations, agreements, industrial discipline. You sign an agreement, you live up to it. And they were much more prepared to knock down brick walls, turn fire hoses onto the offices of Four Broad Meadows, and basically throw tomatoes at the officials, which is what they did in South Australia. And also salami. Don't forget the salami. Now, that's the germ of truth, and a very important germ of truth. The migrant working class will undoubtedly be a crucial element of the next Australian Revolution. But it's not a sufficient condition in itself. You only have to look at the clothing outworkers, or indeed the whole of the clothing industry from the 60s and 70s and 80s, to see workers who are oppressed by many of the same conditions not fighting back and not resisting for the most part. It also ignores the way in which capitalism adapts. In the 50s and the 60s, it was, you know, if you don't speak English, you've got a rotten job in a factory ahead of you, and we're basically going to insist you're a Protestant, and if you're not a Protestant, and you don't speak English, and you don't law the British Crown, there's no place for you in Australian settlement. The 1970s, Whitlam and then Fraser got wise, partly under the impact of the Ford strike in 1973, and the radicalisation amongst iron workers and New South Wales South Coast. They invented this thing called multiculturalism. They began to work through community leaders, to fund these community leaders. In other words, to form a buffer layer, which, if you like, gave some opportunities for some, you know, workers who might otherwise have been radical shop stewards to see they could actually find a place in the system. They become leaders of their community. They could become spokespeople. They could sit on ethnic community councils. They could be on advisory bodies, consultative committees. In other words, capitalism is an adaptable system that can find ways of bringing in and incorporating a layer within the working class, just like it brought in a layer of the working class in the 1890s, in other words, union bureaucracy, to form a buffer between the capitalist class and the working class. Contrast against that, the very stability of the Amalgamated Engineering Union, for example, which organised the trades in the car factories, it meant they weren't as explosive. They didn't generally go knocking down walls and turning fire hoses on the company offices at Ford. But nonetheless, they retained the more long-term, the more steady 100% union organisation on the job. They retained shop committees longer than the Vehicle Builders Production Union did. In other words, they retained a more stable ability to strike and to fight. In other words, the working class needs both. It needs the stability, the structures that are more stably employed workers are able to organise and sustain over a period of time with, if you like, succession planning, as shop stewards train more shop stewards to come through to take up the responsibilities. But also the struggle does need those explosive elements in the working class, you know, to be willing to break through the bureaucratic formalities. Okay, third and finally, I'm going to talk about actually a very influential argument, perhaps underdone if anything in this talk, is the argument of the Communist Party. Through most of its history, well, particularly from the 30s through to the 60s. This is what you might call a left nationalist perspective. The working class as a national democratic vanguard. This picture sums it up. Writers such as Ian Turner, Robin Gollan or Golan, Russell Ward and Brian Fitzpatrick wrote a lot of the staple Labour histories, which are no doubt on the bookstall outside. A very valuable contribution in many respects, but hindered in all cases by a problem, which is a tendency, if you like, to try to fudge the question of the unique particular perspective and role of Australian working class. They tend to all the time due to the impact of Stalinism on Australian Communist Party, to blur the class boundaries between the working class, the middle class, and what some of them called the patriotic, progressive Australian bourgeoisie. Some comrades will recognise this in the politics of the Popular Front. So if you look at this cartoon, what do you see? You see Pig Iron Bob, Menzies, holding up a series of anti-worker and actually also rearmed Japs, kind of told you something about Australian Communist Party politics there as well. And who's standing up to defend him? The Eureka tradition. The gold miner rolling up his sleeves, prepared to knock Pig Iron Bob to six. So the argument, in some ways, if you like, is that the working class tradition in Australia stretches back in a quite uncritical way to the struggles of Eureka, to the struggles of the anti-transportation campaigns of the 1830s, the anti-squatter campaigns of the 1850s, the struggle of good old Ned Kelly, all eventually lead up to the culmination of the Australian people's progressive patriotic struggle with the great strikes of the 1890s. All subsumed into a glorious tradition of progressive Australian nationalism. That Australia is not divided essentially by class, so these writers would argue, but by the people, who are the overwhelming majority of Australian population, and the parasites. These parasites were bankers, monopolists, colonialists, ship owners, imperialists, and hangers-on of the British, the Americans, and more recently the Japanese. The working class struggle is therefore situated as a long struggle that reaches back to 1788 of the Australian people for a fair go. And of course, the struggle of the Australian people for a fair go is not restricted just to the working class, but include all those sections of bourgeoisie and middle class who are not part of the tiny parasitic minority, the top 100 rich families, as the Communist Party put it, who creamed off all the wealth from Australia. The problem with this argument is that twofold. Number one, of course, intended to subsume the class struggle into alliances with sections of the patriotic bourgeoisie and with small business. And so you see a constant tendency in Communist Party writing from the 30s through to the 60s. The Australian working class has to form broad alliances. And in fact, this is not just restricted to the 1950s. What was the accord in the view of the metal workers, other than a broad patriotic alliance with progressive sections of Australian capital, in other words, manufacturing, as against those traitors who would sell off the country to the Japs and the Americans for the sake of a bit of mineral wealth. That effectively was the argument that left nationalists and the AMWU, the Metal Workers Union, put in the late 1970s and early 1980s in order to sell the accord. Okay, to finish. There is no point in trying to find progressive or reactionary or complacent and conservative or radical sections of the working class as a cast-iron, hermetically sealed segments. The Australian working class, both skilled and unskilled, has got a strong tradition of militant industrial struggle. As socialists, we have to cut against the idea that the Australian working class is cut off, is bought off, is complacent. Whether this is argued by the right-wing argument, the John Howards of the world, or indeed by those on the left, like Humphrey McQueen, or the argument for the Labour aristocracy. The problems that the working class face, and there are many in Australia, the problems that we face through the union bureaucracy, through the real opportunists in our society, the people who do look to cut a deal with the system, the union leaders and the Kevin Rudds of the world, we can't find a way out of that just simply by establishing new organisational forms of union or by focusing only on one section of the working class. Instead, we have to have an honest analysis of the working class warts and all, to assess the actual possibilities of the workers, not to seek to impose some schema that a particular type of union organisation, like for that matter the industrial workers of the world, or particular layer of the working class, like the migrant workers, is going to point a way forward. To understand both the strong job organisation and strategic position of the skilled workers, but also to understand a tendency towards routinism, that is, to working within the system. To see the raw power and explosive potential of the migrant workers and assembly line workers and unskilled workers more generally, like the BLs, but also to understand the fact these blow-ups can lapse back into inertia. Ultimately, the lesson from the history of the Australian working class is it comes down to questions of political leadership and having organisation, networks, cadres on the ground in the unions to help to determine the course of class struggle. What's decisive time and again in the whole history of class struggle in Australia is the issue of political leadership and the need to challenge the grip of reformism. That's a project the Socialist Alternative is involved in, and if you agree with our analysis of the need to fight, I'd encourage you to join.